James, D. Davis Construction Corporation versus FPJ East, Stephen Seeger, Alexander List, Appellant Counsel, R. Scott Calkins, Greta Ilya, Appellant Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Seeger. With me at the council table and on brief is Alexander Bush. May it please the court. This case arises out of a series of very standard construction contracts in which the appellant, James G. Davis Construction Corporation, is the general contractor. H&2 Drywall, who is not here, who is the defaulting, defunct subcontractor, was the drywall subcontractor. And Cisco Incorporated was a supplier of drywall materials. The relationship between these parties is all established and kept in order through strict written contracts between the various parties. Now, in addition to the contracts to supply and install the drywall materials between Davis and H&2, and to supply only the drywall materials by Cisco to H&2, there was a guarantee written by the president of H&2 to Cisco. Now, that's relevant in this regard only as it stands in contrast to the joint check agreement. The guarantee.
Council, you indicated this is a fairly standard setup. How often are there joint checking agreements between a contractor and a sub for the benefit of a supplier, in your experience?
They happen very frequently, Your Honor. This is a extraordinarily routine arrangement. In fact, in the Davis subcontract, it is a standard attachment to the subcontract such that subcontractors can offer this to any of its suppliers, and oftentimes subcontractors have multiple suppliers or sub-subcontractors that have joint check agreements. And so this is a very routine arrangement, and that is why this case is as important as it is, because if the law in the Commonwealth is adjusted such that a supplier or a sub-subcontractor can leap the chain of privity under the concept of unjust enrichment, that sets the existing contractual relationships on their ear and even does injustice to what the General Assembly has created, which is an alternate remedy for unpaid suppliers or sub-subcontractors, which is the Mechanics Lien Statute. Because even under the Mechanics Lien Statute, a supplier or a sub-subcontractor has a right to an alternate remedy through a mechanics lien, but under Title 43, specifically Section 43-9, that remedy is limited by the extent to which the party in between is entitled to a lien.
Which is not too dissimilar from the joint checking account agreement.
It's exactly the same. And so the joint check agreement mirrors the statute, the mechanics lien statute, in that regard, because the joint check agreement provides specifically that a condition, the condition being that the supplier is only entitled to payment through a joint check agreement to the extent and on the condition that Davis is obligated to pay the subcontractor, H&2.
Now, your argument is that this, I don't recall your verb, but this essentially undercuts the mechanics lien statute. But isn't that requiring the supplier, who's the weakest link in the chain, who's the one that has the least power, to essentially make a Hobson's choice? I could file a lien, but if I do so, I'm probably harming my ability, almost certainly harming my ability to do business with these subs and generals in the future. And I'm not going to file a lien because I've got this joint checking agreement. And I'm going to rely upon this joint checking agreement. But in this instance, that reliance proved unfounded. So what's your response to that?
Your Honor, there is no Hobson's choice. They can do both. They can file the mechanics lien if they don't get paid, and they can rely upon the joint checking agreement.
Don't you agree that if you file a mechanics lien, you really have harmed your ability to do business in the future with those parties?
Your Honor, there's, as you know, a party can file a mechanics lien or a notice of a mechanics lien at the beginning of the project, before they've even started to provide those materials, to put the world on notice that they're providing the materials and that there may be a claim. That typically, I would agree, is a bad thing to do if you want an ongoing relationship. However, if at the end of the day you have been not paid and you've been damaged, and the only way you can protect your interest is to file a mechanics lien.
But it's not at the end of the day. That's the problem with a lot of these transactions. It's essentially every hour through the day. You're doing work for weeks or months at a time, and you're expecting to get paid during that process. And if at some point that payment spigot dries up, then you really do have the choice that no one wants to have to make. Do I file a mechanics lien, which can stop the project? Because if there's a lender out there that before each draw is doing is looking at the land records, that project can come to a halt because of a small supplier, and that small supplier may get even smaller if he's told we're just not going to do business with you anymore because of that lien. And that's the challenge. I understand your argument, but I'm simply saying you're essentially arguing policy to us, and I'm saying, well, there's a countervailing policy as well.
Yeah, the countervailing policy is that these contractors and these suppliers regulate their business through their contracts, just like the general contractors such as Davis allocate their risks through their contracts. And those risks are taken into the market pricing of the projects. Now, if Davis is to assume, and general contractors are to assume, that they will be liable for effectively double payment in the event of a supplier not getting paid by somebody in between, then they have to price that in. And that's not what the market does. The market presently does not assume that contractors are going to be subject to double payment. And that's what would happen in the event that all of a sudden the law as it relates to mechanics liens, or we create an equitable unjust enrichment cause of action.
In this case, does the record reflect whether Davis paid what they were expecting to for the drywall supplies or more? Or less, and maybe the record doesn't reflect that, but that's I'm curious about. That.
Actually, the record is very clear on this point, and the law in this regard is one of the errors that the trial court made. The trial court ruled that there was no evidence that Davis specifically paid Cisco for the drywall materials, or specifically paid for those materials, and that is not the proper application of the law. The law that has been held by this court, and also by, as well stated in the restatement of contracts, the restatement of third restitution and unjust enrichment at section 25, comment B, is there is no unjust enrichment if Davis paid the contract part price to the subcontractor and others following the default of that subcontractor.
I don't think you're answering my specific question. At the beginning of the project, there was a project budget.
Yes, sir.
And it had a number for the materials for the drywall.
No, sir. That's not how it works. A general contractor does not allocate its cost for drywall labor, drywall materials. The general contractor has a unified price with the subcontractor to provide all the labor, all the materials.
Okay.
In a unified price. It has no knowledge of how they're breaking that out, nor would it. What it does is it pays the subcontractor, in this instance H&2, the full amount of the subcontract for the benefit of installed drywall, not a stack of drywall board and a certain number of drywall installers. It pays for an installed product.
So it doesn't care whether you have this much board or that much labor or whatever. Just get it done. Here's the money.
That's correct. And the stipulations of the parties, paragraph 15 in the stipulations, show that Davis paid on behalf of completing the work more than the subcontract value. And the trial court held...
But you include attorney's fees when you say that, right? You're including attorney's fees when you say that.
And those are... the attorney's fees are entitled under at the very end. And the attorney's fees... Without the attorney's fees, you're within about $9,000.
Right. But what I'm saying is, you're basically saying, yeah, we meant not to pay for the drywall, but we paid for attorney's fees, so in the final analysis, we paid, you know, what we expected to pay for drywall.
Because in order to get, the attorney's fees are incurred as part because of the default of the subcontractor. Not just, those aren't necessarily attorney's fees associated with this litigation. Those were attorney's fees that were incurred long before, when the drywall subcontractor defaulted and had to be replaced. And so the contract provided that in the event of a default, and this is under Section 15...
Don't worry about it. I mean, to me, it just means we ought not count that. But go ahead.
I question, too, whether we're getting lost in the trees and missing the forest. Unjust enrichment is a quasi-contract remedy. It's not to be applied where it's used in a commercially unreasonable context. And how could a supplier commercially and reasonably expect they could in-run the mechanics lien statute, in-run an agreement specific to this one transaction, this checking agreement, and just have a freestanding equitable claim for money damages no matter what the contractual relationships are, no matter what the privity of contract is, and no matter what the General Assembly has given us as the statutory remedy for this problem? Isn't that where the root of this is?
Seems like a friendly question.
I was going to say, you're 100% correct, Your Honor, and with that, if I could, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
I guess I've got a question. What about the specific relationship involved here, where you've got Davis having paid this supplier directly? You know, Davis was paying with his Cisco directly.
And it was not, Your Honor. That's not correct. Davis never paid Cisco directly.
Okay, I thought they were issuing a check to both people, and it was being signed by Cisco, and it was being signed by the drywall company.
That's absolutely correct.
And they had direct contact with Davis and saying, look, we haven't been paid. What's going on here? And Davis said to them, we're going to pay you. Don't worry about it.
They did not say that.
Okay.
What they said is that they said there's money in the contract. They said the condition by which the joint check agreement allows payment, there's money to be paid. There would be money to be paid to H&2. And because there's money that would be payable to H&2, it appears at the time that we will be able to pay you. It ultimately turned out that there was not money available to pay them, and therefore the condition of the joint check agreement and the condition that would have existed under the mechanics lien would never be satisfied, and therefore payment wasn't made. Davis did not say unequivocally, unconditionally, Davis will pay Cisco.
Okay, well, let me just get to the point of this, because I think this is the sense of what the circuit court judge felt, is that we all know that the drywall person had been fired. I mean, they weren't doing what they were supposed to do. They're off the job, right? That happened in March.
In March, that's correct.
Yeah. And at the same time, the drywall people are talking to you all about, hey, this dude's been fired. Where's our money? And you're like, there's money left in the project. You're going to get your money. And they're thinking, well, I'm not going to come by and pick up my drywall that's laying there on the job site because these guys have promised they're going to pay me.
Your Honor, they can't come to the job site and take the drywall off the job site. That would be a tort. That would be theft. The drywall's been delivered. It's on the job. A lot of it's been installed. The supplier can't come and yank it out of the...
No, we're not talking about yanking things out. We're talking about things that haven't been used.
They couldn't. They would not be allowed. They've turned over that material. That material, just because if you sold me something, and I had it at my house, but I didn't pay you for it, you wouldn't be entitled to the self-help to just walk into my house and take it. And this drywall supplier couldn't do that either. So it had its remedies at law. It had its remedies under the mechanics lien statute. And if I could save 35 seconds, I'd like to do that.
32.
Maybe not. Go ahead, Chief Justice. I'm sorry.
He said you have 32.
32. Thank you.
You keep going, you're going to have 25.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Scott Calkins. Greta Iliev is at council table with me, and she is on brief. I'm arguing for the appellee. Your Honors, there's no question in the record, and it was stipulated that no one paid for the drywall, $252,000 worth of drywall that was used in the project.
That's because the party that you contracted with didn't pay you. So that's what happens in commerce.
But we weren't privy, but in this case, there were substantial conversations, direct dealings, directly.
I'm not a commercial player, but I would imagine in commerce, this kind of substantial, please work with me stuff is going on constantly. Why does that set aside the law of contracts or set aside the entire statutory scheme for mechanics lien with this omnibus thought that if some judge thinks is just unfair, unjust, all of the doctrinal things that we use to create social expectations in these contexts are just swept aside with the most ambiguous and undefined concept. How is that reasonable?
Well, with respect to whether somebody in a situation, the supplier would never have a cause of action for unjust enrichment against a party it's not privy to because it's a construction context, I think that where the elements of unjust enrichment are satisfied, that there should be an unjust enrichment claim in that circumstance. With respect to the mechanics lien, it's very interesting because under the statute, essentially in this case, what Davis is saying is, well, we can offset all the expenses and so forth we paid to another contractor against what we would be obligated to pay under an unjust enrichment claim.
You presuppose they would start off that analysis being obligated. If I had a client come into my office and said, well, the supplier's getting hosed by one of the subs, I'm obligated to pay them, I'd say, why would you think that? Oh, because some judge thinks it's unfair later. Well, do you have a contract with them that requires you to? No. Does the mechanics lien statute provide a remedy that you're liable for? No.
Right. Well, Your Honor, under the mechanics lien statute, actually, when you have a situation that a contractor, for example, doesn't have a right to offset claims for completing the project, he has, an owner has that right under 4316, but a contractor doesn't. With respect to a situation that you got here under the specific facts of this case, where you have a contractor who knows that its subcontractor is in serious financial, has in serious financial problems, and in fact can't even pay its employees, and they aren't showing up on the job, and nevertheless has a supplier who is talking directly to the contractor saying, okay, I'm going to hold up product and shipments, and as a consequence, the contractor is assuring them payment is forthcoming, there is payment, there's enough money, and the shipments of product keep flowing, when the contractor knows that the subcontractor can't pay, isn't in a financial position to pay, and knows it's going to benefit when it receives those products, and when it goes out and hires somebody else to complete the project, that person, they're not going to have to pay again for that drywall material because they've got that drywall material that they knowingly used in the project, knowing that the supplier expected to be paid and knowing that the supplier couldn't rely on its subcontractor to pay. Those are the facts in this case.
So the supplier had a reasonable commercial expectation that the risk he was making when he made that, we tried to keep his deal alive directly, that he had a reasonable expectation that the law would say, no, this is not an expectation. You have a right to this. You put the drywall down there, and the law is going to make them pay for it. It's going to imply a contract where there is no contract in situations where it's obviously a commercial risk that's being voluntarily assumed by sophisticated parties.
Well, again, second element is of an unjust enrichment claim, as said in the Schmidt case anyway, is defined in that, is did the parties or should they have had a reasonable expectation
that there would be payment?
And in this case, you know, yes, it is reasonable for Cisco to believe that when it is being told that there is money to pay and we will pay. And in fact, they were told that payments were being made and arrangements were being made to make payment. And on that basis, Cisco continued to supply product to the job site that was used and incorporated in the
job site.
Right.
In terms of the sequence, it's not like the materials were all delivered, just sitting there on the job site, and then the sub starts circling the drain. Instead, if I understand correctly, there were some materials already there, but then to keep things flowing and additional new materials being delivered, Cisco's relying on the assurances of the primary contractor to continue delivering additional new materials. Is that right?
Right. And at the time that the primary contractor, Davis, knew that the subcontractor could not pay for the materials because Davis wanted to benefit.
So I understand a garden variety situation where the contractor just pays a set amount and doesn't worry about supplies, where they're coming from, whatever, as long as the job's getting done. This is a little bit of a different scenario in the sense that you have direct contact between the supplier and the primary contractor, and assurances being made. Look, we all know the sub is having some trouble. Keep the materials coming because there's plenty of money. So in detrimental reliance on that, they do just that.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's what makes it inequitable and unjust in this case. And in fact, you know, Davis in this case, it didn't even disclose all of the problems that its sub was having to the supplier, to Cisco in this case. The project manager said, hey, in cross-examination, why didn't you, because it was none of their business. I mean, they knew information that would be helpful, and they didn't communicate that.
Did they have to communicate that information?
They didn't have to communicate it, Your Honor, but the fact that they didn't communicate it when there was an expectation, they knew there was an expectation by Cisco that payment would be forthcoming because they had been told that, and they knew information that it would indicate, well, if you're relying, Cisco, on your sub to pay you, we know information that's not going to happen. We're not going to tell you because it's none of your business.
I mean, one of the things we're trying to figure out is, I mean, we don't want to blow up this ordinary contractual principles, mechanics lien principles, and upend an entire industry based on this amorphous, equitable situation. On the other hand, question is this sufficiently anomalous, and does it cross the line into this sort of gross unfairness as opposed to just raw contractual bargaining power issues? And I think that's the heart of it.
All right, and I understand that, and I hear that, Your Honor. And you know, that's kind of a big public policy argument that has been made here. But this is a specific case, and you have to take these on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, this is a case where Davis could have protected itself. It could have done what, for example, take the lesson in the cases that Davis cites in response to the first assignment of error, where the suits were on a joint check agreement or joint payment agreement, sometime referred to, and the issue there was consideration.
Why couldn't Cisco protect itself when it said, you know what, I've got a guarantee from the principal of H&2, but I'm not happy with that because I don't trust his solvency either. If you really want me to supply your subcontractor, I need a more robust promise of payment with some kind of expectation that there's no cap on a joint checking agreement.
Well, Cisco, at that point, again, working commercially, reasonable way, went directly to and communicated in direct communication with the contractor who is given these constant assurances.
So you have an agreement between Cisco and the general contractor for exactly the situation we're sitting around debating. And the agreement was bilateral. The trial judge said there was no consideration. I find that difficult to grasp. There was bilateral consideration under my hypothetical. And your client did not negotiate enough of a remedy to file that claim. They had a contractual relationship with no remedy because of a failure of negotiation. And all we're doing is taking an equitable concept and sidelining both a statutory scheme and a contractual scheme among sophisticated commercial parties.
But that could happen in any case, in a contract and business sense case, where you have an unjust and the availability and opportunity for an unjust enrichment claim, where parties don't and didn't contract and aren't privy.
No, if you have an express contractual relationship, the first premise, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, with quasi contract theory is you don't drop down to an implied in law theory. Implied in law theories are made up theories. Judges make them up. They don't exist in any sort of subjective consensual agreement between the underlying parties. So the first premise appears to be where the parties have subjectively, on their own, agreed to here's what the rules are going to be, in this case a joint checking account agreement. Why would the courts, this is not a policy question, this is the definition of unjust enrichment, why would the courts come in and remedy a problem that was unnegotiated in the first instance?
Well, again, you get back to the equities of the case. Thus, are the various elements of an unjust enrichment case met? Would it be inequitable under these particular factual scenario, particular circumstances, where there isn't a contract, when the parties aren't in privy, to still allow a cause of action?
Why isn't the joint checking agreement a contract?
Because it said it wasn't a contract. And quite frankly, that from in the pleading and in their answer, Davis took the position, said lack of privity, lack of absence of contract. By its terms, it says it creates no contractual obligation between Davis and Cisco. So it wasn't. It's not something that anybody could ever should have relied on. And in fact, Davis didn't rely on it. Davis didn't feel it precluded some other method of payment, of direct payment, because ultimately Davis did set up a separate checking arrangement with Cisco and told Cisco after that it would make payments for these materials that have been delivered to the project and used in the project, then decide after talking with counsel that it wouldn't make those payments. So there was this direct, it's the direct dealings, direct discussions, and again, it's a very fact-specific situation, and as all unjust enrichment cases are. In this case, Davis, I want to point out, because there was discussion about these offsets that were used, and there was a question about attorney's fees. Actually, what the stipulation says, it's in the record, was at the time that the H&2, the subcontractor, was terminated, there was still over approximately $300,000 left for this whole drywall scope of work that had not been paid. At that point, it was available. What did Davis end up doing with that $300,000? Well, it ended up paying other suppliers of Cisco. Davis, not Cisco. That's one thing. And then it went out and hired another contractor. One thing is clear. In those payments, it didn't pay for another $252,000 worth of drywall material, which would have had to do when its subcontractor defaulted if it didn't have that material to use.
In the joint checking agreement, wasn't it clear to both parties that when you walked away from signing that document, there was no enforceable right, equitable or legal, from Cisco directly against the general for unpaid supplies to the sub?
That's not, Your Honor, that's not what the agreement says, what the joint check agreement says. If nothing in this agreement creates any contractual obligation between Cisco or Davis or equitable obligation.
So you
nothing, and it's a payment arrangement. I think the judge, trial judge, correctly described it as a payment arrangement.
So a commercial party walks away from making that deal where it's understood, we've just talked about the very issue of payment and how this is going to work. Gentlemen, you understand, I mean, we're not agreeing to any equitable remedies, we're not agreeing to any contractual remedies, and you walk away and you say silent to yourself, doesn't matter because I have it anyway. It's in my back pocket. Why didn't even come in here and argue with these people?
Your Honor, I see my time has expired.
Do you have a question, Cindy?
Yes. Is that what happened?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I wasn't clear on the question.
The joint checking agreement
right.
Presupposed the parties understood there was no direct remedy, and yet what's happened is you acquired an indirect remedy. Why would that be commercially reasonable as a matter of law?
So the joint check agreement, Your Honor, did not create any expectation one way or the other. It was just a method of payment. Why was it? Is it reasonable for Cisco to believe and expect that it was going to be paid? All of the communications, all of the discussions that went back and forth created that expectancy, which is the basis here for this unjust enrichment claim.
Counsel, I have a question as well.
We ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Counsel, I have a question as well. Having done a few of these through the years, the $252,000 of drywall, I presume, was taken to the job site over a period of time.
Correct.
And at some point during that period of time, HN2 quit paying Cisco. And if there had not been the communication from Davis, then every time that Cisco dropped off a load of drywall, it would have had to make a decision. Do I incur this risk, or do I file a mechanics lien to protect myself? Is that how it would have worked? And so it was the communication from Davis that caused Cisco to say, I'm going to take the risk and not file the mechanics lien, giving up the only security it had.
That's correct. Okay. That was the evidence at trial that they forbore on filing a mechanics lien. They also, the evidence at trial was that in February they were going to stop shipping, but they then went ahead and shipped after they got assurance from the project manager, Mr. Mahoney, that there was money to pay for materials and that payments would be made.
Okay.
So it's
a question.
Yes.
Thank you,
Counselor. Thank
you. Rebuttal. You have 32 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the chronology as referenced is not correct. The last communications from Davis about payment to Cisco related to payments that were in fact made by Davis to H&T. Davis only found out about that there was financial problems in January of 2017. They went out of business in March of 2018, and not all of the deliveries were in that time period. It's in our facts. If I could, Your Honors,
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Call the next case.